Hey, this weekend, Diane and I were supposed to be in Florida seeing her parents. Her parents are declining, and we wanted to be with them, but Diane came down with a croup. It sounds like a kid disease, but my wife got it. And so she was too sick to travel, so we stayed. I had arranged for someone to speak, and I thought it was very clear to me that the Lord said, no, that's who I want to have speak this week. So I'm really excited to introduce to you our speaker. He is originally from Augusta, Georgia, so in his blood is called golf. There is golf inside his blood. It just pumps inside of there. He went to Augusta State University. He was an English major there. And right out of school, he went on staff with Young Life, which is a ministry to high school students all over the country. For me, I'm fortunate, I'm lucky that where I grew up was the headquarters of Young Life in Colorado Springs. And that's how I came to Christ, was at a Young Life camp in Minnesota called Castaway. For the very first time, I understood this incredible message of Christ. And I thought as a 15-year-old, that makes sense to me. Now, I've rethought it every year since then, and that still makes sense to me. And it still takes me back to this cliff overlooking Pelican Lake to say, yeah, I still choose Christ. And so Tom has been doing that for 30 years. He is now the regional director, the Gateway Region, which includes eastern Kansas, eastern Nebraska, and all of Missouri, and even the Metro West. So he directs, and they have staff all over that area and volunteers that are trying to help reach high school kids. And it's called Young Life in High School, and in junior highs, it's called Wildlife. Is that like the greatest name ever? It is like so appropriate. I love it. But I asked Tom Pruden. His wife Maggie is here, and his kids Will and Yates are here. And Will is a student at Fontbonne. Yates is at Eureka High School. But their family has been a part of Quest for a few months, and we're just so glad to have Tom come share with us from God's Word. So, Tom, thank you.
Thanks, Kev. It's good to be with y'all this morning, and I want to thank Kevin as I get this set up here for the opportunity to speak. It may be the last time that I speak here. You never know. But a couple thoughts. I'm very thankful for Kevin. As he said, we've been attending since November. We were at E-Free years ago for a number of years, and that's where I first met Kevin and got to know Kevin a little bit, but just so appreciate his heart, how he leads with grace and truth, and it just means the world to me that you would take time this morning to help us to pray and focus with Parkland. Another deep, deep tragedy, and Kevin's right. I just, breaks my heart when it gets politicized. Because the truth is, we so desperately need Jesus. Our world, our country, desperately needs him. So, anyway, thank you for praying, and I pray that we would continue to pray in the days, the weeks, the months that come for wisdom from lawmakers and from wisdom of the church that we can change this and make a difference. Maggie and I have been married for almost 28 years, and I realize this morning as I stand here, I don't know a lot of y'all, and it's funny the dynamics, and I'll be moving a little bit. I hope that's not too distracting. I can't stay put in one spot. I speak to high school and college age students a lot all over the place, and particularly at Young Life camps. I've had the privilege to speak at Castaway a number of times where Kevin met the Lord. But one thing that's different here, that's not there. Usually, everybody's jammed up front. And I mean, it's close and packed in. And I know we've got a more reserved crowd this morning. So, just, I'd love to open, if I could, with just a little story. It's an epic story of romance and adventure. So, would you humor me? May I open with a story of epic romance and adventure? Yes? No? Come on, this is interaction time here. Here we go. Thank you. We're not dead. Okay. Every great story starts with the words, thank you. Once upon a time, in a corn country, there lived a beautiful girl named Rendersella. Rendersella lived with her muggly other and her three Sigliesters. Also in this corn country, there lived a Pransome Hence, who decided to throw a Bansome Fall. To the Bansy Fall, he invited people from Riles a Mound, especially the Pitch Reaple. So Rendersoe's Mugly Other and Three Sigliesters all went out and bought Drancy Festus so they'd go to the Bansy Fall. But Rendersoe just cat down a shride. All she had to wear were old Rudy Dags. Suddenly, as she was crying, along came her Gary Fodmother, and she maved her magic wand. And there before Rendersoe appeared a Drancy Fest, a Kickboats, and Hicksite Warses. So Rendersoe could go to the Bansy Fall. But her Gary Fodmother warned her, "Rendersoe, you must be home before the mid-clock strikes night, or I'll pern you into a tumpkin." So off Rendersoe went to the Bansy Fall, and she was met by the Prancing Hens, for he'd been watching from a widden hindow. Rendersoe and the Prancing Hens nanced all night, and alas, they lull and fove. Suddenly, the mid-clock struck night. Rendersoe staced down the rares, but just as she beached the rottom, she slopped her dripper. The next day, the Prancing Hens went all over the corn country, looking for the beautiful burl who slopped her dripper. Finally, he came to Rendersoe's house. He tried to slop dripper on the Mugly Other. Fiddened it. Then he tried to slop dripper on the Three Sigliesters. Fiddened it. Then he slopped dripper on Rendersoe, and it fidded it. As a fatter of Mac, it was exactly the sight rise. Rendersoe and the Prancing Hens lived happily ever after. And the story of the Maury is this. Ladies, if you want a Prancing Hens to loll and fove with you, don't forget to slop your dripper. Thank you very much. I feel I feel at home with y'all now, like we've been close friends for many, many years. How many of y'all have ever been to a wedding that just didn't go as maybe you expected or the bride and groom expected? Maybe the bride or the groom or some guests found themselves a little embarrassed. I want to share with you, I've had the privilege and love, one of my favorite things is officiating weddings of former Young Life students or leaders or staff, and it's been a privilege. But almost 28 years ago, June 23rd, I was involved with a wedding, and the groom ended up being a little embarrassed. And it's hard to embarrass this groom because that groom happens to be me. And I don't get embarrassed very easily, but it was, Maggie grew up in Birmingham, I grew up in Augusta, I was working for Young Life in Jackson, Mississippi. We'd met, that's another story for another time, but we lull and fove, and she slopped her dripper, and all that kind of stuff. But we were getting married, and we decided, you know, we were going to kind of make it a long weekend out of it. So I came to Birmingham on Wednesday, my groomsmen came in from all over the place, and we played a lot of golf, and we had great fun together. And then Friday comes, we had the rehearsal, we rehearsed, everything went well, we had the rehearsal dinner, go back to the hotel, and at about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, all of my groomsmen enter my hotel room, and they said, "Tom, this is your last night of singlehood, we just want to spend some time praying with you." That's what their words said. Their eyes said, "Brother, you're in trouble," and boy was I. There was no praying. There was none. That was a total lie. Next thing I know, they are on top of me, stripping off my clothes, and they put on a leopard skin bikini brief. This is why I may never speak here again, right here. And they duct taped my feet and my arms and my mouth. Now, if today, in this day and age, somebody surely would have stopped this, right? Seeing this, you know, guy coming out of a hotel room like this, no. So they take me to this place in town in Birmingham called Five Points. It's kind of a sketchy place in town. They put goggles over my eyes. They cut the duct tape off, and they handcuff me to a park bench. They take Karo syrup and pour it all over me, and then they had down pillows that they just... Yes, I was syruped and feathered the night before my wedding. If that were not enough, throughout the evening, they snapped photographs, you know, of the evidence and that whole deal. So they handcuffed me to this park bench, and they leave me. They're gone for like 20 or 30 minutes. I don't know if they went and got something to eat, what they did, but I'm sitting here on this park bench, you know, with almost not even dressed, just this little thing on. And then all of a sudden I look up. Here comes two of Birmingham's finest police pull up. They roll down the window. They look at me, and they both just shake their head, roll the window up, and drive away. I'm like, are you serious? You're just going to leave me here. So my friends, if we call them that, they come back. They unhandcuff me. They're laughing. You know, we go back to the hotel. They're snapping more pictures. I wonder what the housekeepers thought the next morning in the bathtub. You know, there's this pile of feathers. And so fast forward to the next day of the wedding. Maggie and I are up front, and or actually she's not come in yet. The groomsmen are procession, and they blow feathers right at the deal. So there's this pile of feathers, and they've got messages, you know, and all this kind of thing. It was crazy. And then the worst, at the reception, there were 8x10 and 4x6 or 4x5 glossy photos of me, syrupped and feathered, and standing in different places. And I have to tell you, I was a little embarrassed. It was fun, but I was embarrassed. A little over 2,000 years ago, there was a wedding in the town of Cana in Galilee. John records it in John 2. And Jesus was invited to this wedding. And because Jesus was invited, and because he showed up, he saved the bride and the groom from a little bit of embarrassment. And I want us to take a few minutes this morning and look at this account. John 2. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. I want to stop here. There is a lot to unpack here. First of all, John, the writer. This is John the disciple. This is John who, I love the moniker he gives himself. He says, he calls himself the disciple whom Jesus loved. He walked with Jesus for 3 years. He knew and experienced Jesus' great affection for him. And so he records this. And he starts in chapter 1. He talks about how in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He talks about Jesus, the Word, creating everything into being. And then I love, in verse 14, he says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. I love Peterson as he's written it in the message. He says, the Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. Later in chapter 1, Jesus calls his very first disciples. And right here, right before John picks it up in John 2, in this wedding in Cana, Jesus called Nathanael. Now, Nathanael, we learn later, was from Cana. In chapter 21, John 21 in verse 2, it says, I don't have this up here, so I'm just going with it. It says, Peter, Thomas, called Didymus. Now, I got to stop here. If you were here when Thomas Lothman did his little elder moment, I loved it, that they call him Tilo. I love that. And Thomas, who was called Didymus, I'm sure if Thomas Lothman and Thomas Didymus were hanging around, Thomas Lothman would call him T. Diddy, correct? Got to be T. Diddy. And then it goes on and says Nathanael, who is from Cana. So, John is writing this. He's given us his perspective. Jesus had just called Nathanael to come follow me. And he tells him at the end of chapter 1, you know, he says, hey, you follow me because I told you that I saw you under this tree before I called you. You're going to see greater things than this. And boy, would he. Now, the other thing I noticed, did you catch the first phrase? On the third day. What does that remind you of? On the third day. It's an allusion, if you will. It's a foreshadowing to the resurrection. On the third day, Jesus rose again. Isn't it interesting that, and I love, we're about to start this, Kevin's going to lead us through this sermon series, looking at the, the parables of the Holy Week, of the Passion Week. And so the final miracle that Jesus performs is he conquers death. He comes out of the grave so that we might live life to the full. Isn't it interesting that the very first recorded miracle that Jesus does, we're told on the third day, a wedding took place. Do you see the similarities? Now, what does on the third day mean? Well, scholars are conflicted. Some believe that back in these days, wedding celebrations would go for a week, sometimes 2 weeks. I mean, in the Jewish culture back in the day, it was a party. Folks would gather. They came in from out of town all over the place. So some scholars think the third day they actually got married. They actually performed their nuptials, and they were joined, and the celebration continued. Other scholars believe, no, it's a reference back to Jesus calling Nathanael. From the third day after he called Nathanael, boom, they show up in Cana. I don't know. I don't know that it matters. I just think it's interesting that they go to the third day. Did you catch the guest list? It says Jesus' mother was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. One thing we learn about Jesus as we thumb the pages of the gospel: Jesus was the life of the party. Jesus loved to be with people. And people loved to be with Jesus. He got invited to dinner parties. He got invited to weddings. He got invited to funerals. Any part of life, Jesus wanted to be there. And he was there. And he brought life. And he brought laughter. The account continues. And it says this: when the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." I love this. Picture the scene. Great festival. Celebrating this bride and this groom. We don't know how many people were there. There could have been 25, could have been 40, could have been 500. But the celebration is going. There's life, there's laughter. There's this new life, this new family being formed. There's a great feast, there's spread. And there's wine. It's wine in this culture was like similar to water in ours. I mean, can you imagine being at a wedding reception and there's nothing to drink? I mean, and I'm not speaking alcohol. I'm talking water, just to wash food down. This is what wine was in their culture. Isn't it interesting? The person who notices the wine is gone is Mary, the mother of Jesus. I love that. I crack up. Maggie works at a little clothing store here in town part-time, and she said, you may not think it's funny, we'll see, but in December, she was working, and she kind of overheard a conversation with two of the other employees, and they said, "You know, isn't it funny, the Protestants are all about Mary during December. When it's Christmas time, it's Mary all the time. But they don't want anything to do with her the last 11 months of the year. What's up with that?" I thought that was funny. Maybe not so much. And we're not called to pray to Mary. Mary does not intercede for us. Only Jesus does. But Mary played an incredible role in God becoming flesh. And she was the one who the Father chose to be the mother of Jesus. She was very in tune with what was going on this day. I wonder if she wondered about the embarrassment that it might have for if they ran out of wine. Would the party stop? You know, one of the things I love about the scriptures, these are real people. These are not people that we've just put on great pedestals. And they are real people. I wonder what she was thinking that day. I wonder if she hearkened back to her wedding day. You know, her wedding day is not recorded in Scripture. I wonder what it was like, because if you recall, here was probably a 14-year-old Jewish girl that was pregnant out of wedlock. What kind of wedding would she have? I don't know. But I think of her trying to explain to her mother and father. Can you imagine that conversation? No. The angel of the Lord appeared to me. I'm carrying God's son. No, I've not been with Joseph. And we know how Joseph responded. He was ready to set and divorce her quietly, if you will, until the angel appeared to him and said, "No, Joseph, I have done this great thing." I can't imagine. Was she hearkening back to that day? Did you notice that Jesus was there, the disciples were there, probably his brothers? Also, we learn in verse 12 as it concludes. But do you catch who was missing? Joseph. Many scholars believe, because there's not much mention of Joseph, that sometime before Jesus started his public ministry here, Joseph died. And so then Mary became a single mother, with Jesus probably assuming the role of head of the house. I also wonder, as she and Jesus get into this conversation, they have no more wine, and Jesus is like, "Mom, what's that got to do with me? My time has not yet come." And then she says to the servants, "Hey, maybe there's a wink. Do whatever he tells you." Why would she do this? Well, if you remember, and Kevin preached on this or taught us on this back in Advent. Do you remember the angel comes to Mary, tells her what's going to happen? I'm sure she was freaking out at some point. I would be. If I were Joseph, I would be going, "Whoa, come on." But in Luke 2:19, after the shepherds have come, and all their conversation, the things that they said about Jesus and about the event, it says this, Scripture says, "But Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart." And then if you fast forward into Luke, to Luke 2:51b, if you remember, Mary and Joseph and the family and traveling with their clan, they went to Jerusalem, and then they headed back to Nazareth. They had come back from Egypt now. Jesus was about 12, and they had come back, and they realized the second or third day, "Uh-oh, anybody seen Jesus? We thought he was with you." Not even going to go into the 400 stories I could tell you about losing a child, because boy, have I done it. But they lost him. They go back to Jerusalem. They find him teaching in the temple. Listening and soaking it up. And Jesus says, "Hey, didn't you know I'd be about my Father's business?" And if I'm Mary and Joseph, I'm going, curveball there. But no, remember what the angel told us. And it says again, "But Mary treasured all these things in her heart." Here's my question. At this point, at this moment in history, did Mary know what Jesus was capable of? Did Mary know what he would do and what he could do? I want to play a song right now, and It's a song that we hear at Christmas time, and you've probably heard it, but the words, they're going to scroll the words up here as the song plays. Would you just listen to these words? And I want to encourage you, what words or phrases resonate with your heart or capture your attention? Go ahead and let it roll, guys.
Mary, did you know that your baby boy will one day walk on water? Mary, did you know that your baby boy will save our sons and daughters? Did you know that your baby boy has come to make you new? And this child that you've delivered will soon deliver you. Mary, did you know that your baby boy will give sight to a blind man? Mary, did you know that your baby boy will calm a storm with his hand? Did you know?
She had an inkling. I think she had watched her little boy grow in strength and wisdom. She knew that he could change this embarrassing situation. The account continues. It says, nearby stood six water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." What changed from, "Hey, Mom, what does this have to do with me?" to now Jesus is saying to the servants, "Hey, go fill these water jars." I think John 5:19 happened. Jesus says, "I do nothing on my own initiative, only what I see my Father in heaven doing." I think if after this interaction with his mom, he's going, "Father, do you want me to do something?" Don't know if that happened. I suspect it did. And I imagine the father said, hey, Jesus, it's go time. We're going to start this. Here we go. This is the time. And so he does it. And he tells the servants to take these 6 stone water jars, about 150 gallons of water, used for ceremonial washing. We don't know a lot about ceremonial washing in our day, but I want to give you a little clue about ceremonial washing. The guests would have traveled. In the Jewish culture, this is where the water that they used to wash hands and to wash feet. Many people walked barefoot. If they could afford sandals, they would wear sandals. And when they arrived in the home, they would remove them and they would wash their feet. They would wash their hands. I don't want to be really crass here, but Jesus asked these guys to fill 6 stone water jars that had been used for ceremonial washing. We're talking toe juice here. I mean, seriously. I mean, it's dirty, nasty, crusty water. And he tells them to fill it. And then somewhere in here, John doesn't tell us, but that water became the choicest of wine. He says, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. Really? You want me to take that over there? Do you notice the servants didn't hesitate? Why? I mean, their job is on the line, right? And they don't hesitate. I wonder if they smelled the aroma of the wine. Maybe. I think it's because they trusted Jesus. I don't know what it was in the voice of how he encouraged him to do it, but he transformed this water into the choicest of wine, and they took it. Now get this. They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Oh, yeah. They knew where it came from, no doubt. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choicest wine first, then the cheaper wine, after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now. In my mind's eye, I wondered, did Jesus go, hey, Peter, Nathaniel, John, Watch this. I don't think he did that, but I would have. You know, I would have said, watch this, the reaction, but it didn't happen. But what Jesus did do, he saved the bride and groom a lot of embarrassment. He made the choicest of wine. You see, Jesus met the bridegroom and the bride's need even before they knew they had a need. So, the final verse 11, it says, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. His disciples put their trust in Jesus. I bet the servants did too. Can you imagine what they must have felt after that? And Jesus brought to life a wedding party. He brought new life, real life, life to the full. So, as we close, a few reflections or thoughts that I think we can take from John 2. Number one, Jesus cares about the little things in our lives, because he deeply cares about us. His first miracle was not restoring sight or hearing to a broken person. It was not calming a raging storm with his mere voice, nor was it raising anyone from the dead. His first miracle was turning water into wine so that the party can continue. He cares about the details in your life and in mine. He cares about the little things, and he cares about the big things. because he is head over heels in love with you and me. Second thing, did you catch this? Jesus was invited. He was invited to this wedding. He was invited to bring the solution to a problem so that the celebration could continue. What are you wrestling with in your own life that you need to invite him into? Is there a situation at work or school that you've not been able to figure out on your own? You're at the end of your rope. Is there a relationship with a family member that just isn't going like you'd hoped it would? Is there tension? Friends, invite Jesus into it. Have you invited him to be the center of your life? He who turned ordinary water into the choicest of wine can step into my life, into your life, and walk with us and change things. And as we move toward Easter, I want to invite you to do something. You know, many times in this Lenten season, we're called to give something up. I want to call you to take something on. Open the pages of the gospel and sit and invite Jesus to show you, where do I need you today? Where do I need you right now? Jesus, will you come? Will you walk with me? And then the last thing, and there's a million things we can draw from this, but the last. The disciples believed in him. They trusted him, and we can too. Will you trust him with your life? Will you trust him with your circumstances? If Jesus can take 150 gallons of dirty water and turn it into the choices of wine, just think what he can do with you and with me. Will you trust him? Will you trust him in the waiting? I close with this, and I'll be very brief. Maggie and I long to have kids. We've worked with kids, and we love kids. But we had trouble. For 6 years, we tried, and we kept having miscarriage after miscarriage. We had 3 miscarriages. And it was difficult. It was a time of loss. I was like, God, where are you? And then we were pregnant the 4th time. And doctors had done some things, put her on progesterone, and we had always lost the babies between 7 and 12 weeks. And I was at the Young Life office. This is long before cell phones. Phone rings. It's Maggie. She goes, hey, I'm spotting and cramping. They want me to come in. So hang up the phone. I drive to the house. She's getting ready. And I remember sitting in my chair and just journaling. And I journaled this. God, why would you allow us to continue to get pregnant and yet rob us of hope? I mean, I was just being honest with God. I'm here to tell you, I had to learn to trust him in the waiting. A few months later, that 21-year-old popped out. He was 3 pounds, 14 ounces. We named him John William Pruden II. And my sister dubbed him God's Will. Then we had Yates a few years later, 3 years later. Friends, here's what I'm trying to say. I had to trust the one who could turn water into the choicest of wine. He took our loss and our pain and our suffering, and he gave us God's will. So, will you trust him today, tomorrow, this week? Will you lean not on your own understanding, but will you trust him?